This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The biggest solar farm in the U.S. has made headlines, and it's going to be built right here in Indiana. What makes our state the perfect place for such a large-scale project, and what does it mean in the long run when it comes to creating clean energy? With us now to discuss more on what's being dubbed the Mammoth Project is Nick Cohen, CEO of Doral LLC. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Miriam.
Nick, tell us about your company and how it became involved in the energy industry before we get more in depth into exactly what solar energy is.
Well, our company is comprised of a whole bunch of energy executives who have spent most of their career developing renewable energy projects. And in particular, we've concentrated in the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic regions of the U.S. So we headquartered our company in the Chicago and Philadelphia areas. And it's important because that's where most of us live. We have our relationships and we understand the market, and we're able to get in our car and go out and touch and see every site and interact with stakeholders.
What made you choose Indiana for this particular project?
Well, Indiana is actually the most competitively advantaged state that I can think of. Firstly, you have two grid systems which are physically and commercially together in Indiana. You have PJM, which is the largest open access grid system in the world, and it covers 13 states and the District of Columbia. It's basically the Mid-Atlantic region, and then it runs all the way west to Chicago. And then you have the MISO grid, which runs from basically Canada all the way down south to Louisiana. And when you can put a project right at the intersection of two markets, that's an advantage for the project and for the location. Also, Indiana has the flattest land, and solar is the lowest cost energy source out there. And the margins are tight, and it's very important not to have to do a lot of site work. Well, if you've driven in Indiana, you can see that the land is as flat as the eye can see, and there's not a lot of bedrock, so it's very easy to install the racks. So you have site advantages, you have grid advantages, you have demand from the utilities and corporations who are buying renewable energy in Indiana. And then the last thing I would say is that Indiana, the state, and also Stark and Pulaski counties where we're doing our projects, they're open for business. They realize the competitive advantage, and they are doing everything they can to not only bring the solar projects, but also the industry cluster that comes around them. It's not just the solar project. It's all of the companies that service the solar projects, and it's manufacturers who will come to Indiana just to get the power.
Do you think this project would be able to bring jobs to the area, or is it just once it's done being built, the jobs will go away?
Oh, it will definitely bring jobs, lots of jobs. We've guaranteed jobs in Stark County. First, you do have a two-year construction period where there will be at least 500 local people employed in the construction of it. And, you know, I think that's very meaningful. It's hundreds of millions of investment. And then during the operations of the project, there are about 20 full-time people directly involved in the project. And then you have the industry cluster around it, which are dozens more people doing everything from vegetation management to supporting the various operating needs of the project. You have manufacturers, you have electrical companies that base their operations around the cluster. So, you know, I think it's quite a bit of jobs are created. Plus, you get the economic impact of increased taxes that these projects contribute and economic payments.
I read that this project is estimated at about $1.5 billion. How does a project like this get funded? Is this something that taxpayers are going to be contributing to? Should they be concerned at all about that?
No. It's all privately funded. Basically, development is a two-step process. First, we come along and we invest several million in getting the permits and the commercial contracts and getting it to the shovel-ready position. And then the step two is financing it much in the way that you would finance a house. And you go out and you get debt. And it's mostly name banks like the Bank of America's and J.P. Morgan's of the world and New York Infrastructure Funds that they come in and they provide the debt for the project. And then, you know, the company provides the equity.
How does the program work exactly? Do you lease land and you place solar panels on it for a period of time and then take them off? Or do you purchase land?
Well, I think the most important thing that we've learned from talking to the farmers, who, by the way, are also sophisticated business people, is that their farms are generational. And I mean, we literally have people in their mid-90s who were born in the house that is hosting the panels. And they do not want to give up their farms. So leasing makes the most sense for everybody. And at the end of the lease period, say 30 years, they can give the land back to their grandchildren to farm it if they want to. And, you know, the economic impact of these projects on these farms, in many cases, is saving the farms. So we're proud to be able to keep the farms in the family. And when we're finished, we'll remove the panels and the land will be returned to the farmers, and the land will be in better condition than we found it, because going fallow for 30 years has a positive impact on the land for farming.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that, about the land? Because when I learned about it, I was really intrigued, because I never thought, I just imagined panels being, you know, pushed into the ground and then that's it. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, well, for one thing, there's no cement or anything like that. The racks, there are metal posts that are put into the ground, and then the panels are bolted onto the racks. They're the same panels that you see on top of schools and houses. There's nothing exotic about them. And then they're designed, in our case at least, and I think you'll see more of this, with the land in mind. We're doing something called agrivoltaics, where we have various forms of agriculture taking place within the solar array. So in some sections, there will be sheep grazing. In other sections, there will be pollinator crops, which, you know, if you've been following, you know, some of the stresses on the environment, you would see that the pollinators, the bees, the butterflies, are under quite a bit of stress, and in part because in the farming country, there aren't a lot of native weeds growing within the farm field. So we're bringing those back, so there'll be pollinators. And then we also have some crops that we are working the science on right now. For example, in northern Indiana, blueberries are something that grows very well in the sandy soil. So that, you know, so the ecological impact on that the solar farm has on the area is very positive.
What do you think is causing, there are some folks who are concerned and may not be on board with solar energy being put on their land. What do you think is leading to that misinformation or misunderstanding that's out there?
Well, I mean, for one thing, every farmer has the right to say yes or no. And I think some farmers are never presented the opportunity because they're not near the grid lines. And so it could be just human nature to be a little jealous, you know, but I think most of the time it's just misinformation that, you know, in these times, it's very easy to spread incorrect information through social media, and people don't know what to believe, understandably, because they're not solar experts. And some of the rumors are scary. I've heard rumors about the solar arrays changing the weather patterns and causing radiation as a health concern. None of these things are true. But if you see that in social media, you won't know what to believe. And so I think that there's a lot of misconceptions out there. Not that many, though, because when we have our public meetings and we have our social gatherings, it's usually 95% of the people are for it. The people understand the economic uplift and the positive impact of the environment. So I really do think that there's quite a bit of support at all levels within the communities for solar.
When will the Mammoth Project be complete? You said about 2 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, we're phasing it. So the first phase will be completed by mid-2023, and that's 400 megawatts in Stark County. And then the remaining 900 megawatts will be completed in 2024, and that's in Pulaski County. And it's all on the same grid line.
So what can we expect in the relatively near future with this project? You symbolically broke ground, I think, recently. Has anything been built yet?
Well, we had a terrific ribbon-cutting ceremony, and we had the governor. We had diplomats. One of our investors is from Israel, and so we had the Israeli ambassador there. Altogether, about 250 community leaders were at the ribbon cutting in Stark County on October 14th. So from that point, we've started, there's quite a bit of engineering work going on, and the mobilization will happen over the winter. And then in the spring, we'll start putting pilings in for the racks. So the metal posts will be hammered in starting in the spring, and the first panels will start showing up in the fall.
Well, thank you so much, Nick, for joining us and giving us all that insight and information. Nick Cohen, CEO of Doral LLC. Coming up, we'll hear from two retired engineers who also have experience with solar. One of them uses it on his farm. We'll learn more about why they say solar energy is misunderstood. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about the new solar farm coming to Indiana that is expected to be up and running within the next few years or so, and it's expected to be the largest one in the U.S. so far. Solar farms have some area residents concerned about various things, and in particular, the future of farming. We're going to hear from two guests who have experience using solar, and also they'll help us understand where some of this hesitancy comes from. Daryl Bogus is a retired engineer with Solarize Indiana, and Pete Lenzen is a retired engineer, farmer, and volunteer with Siren. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. I think maybe Pete should start with landowner's perspective.
We could do that, but I'd love to hear a little bit of a backstory from each of you into how you got involved in solar. Daryl, if you don't mind telling us.
Okay, we can do that. I grew up in a small town, Austin, Evansville, coal mining community. Most of the men in my family were in coal for a very long time, more than a century now. And I recognized early the health risk of that. And it's just not a good thing to be close to coal in any form. So this is an opportunity for me to help create a better future for my children, my grandchildren. And I think it's really important for the quality of the air, the water, land, all of that.
And Pete, what about you? What's your history with solar?
Well, I'm a retired nuclear engineer with the Navy. I've been interested in solar for a long time. I ended up living in Bloomington, working in manufacturing plants. I have solar at my house since 2015. I operate a farm in western Nebraska. And then we use solar there to power irrigation pumps and water wells, submersible pumps to bring water up for cattle. Unfortunately, that western Nebraska isn't next to a big energy hub like the previous guys were talking about, MISO and PGM. But solar is very important. I have a farming background. I have a lot of concerns about removing farmland for solar but there's middle ground. And I think the important thing is to say, get beyond the yes solar, no solar, you know, back and forth, which we see in today's politics, but to get into the nuance. And it was wonderful to hear, you know, the company talk about agrivoltaics. You know, that's a term that very few people have heard. We don't hear a lot about that in Indiana. But this has been going on for 10 years. You know, if the listeners want to learn more about what that means, just Google Jack's Solar Garden. Jack's Solar Garden is a large solar array in Boulder, Colorado, that's been going on for years, and they developed a very innovative way of doing this. You can have ways of farming and doing solar. Maybe you plant the solar arrays 8 feet apart where you can drive a tractor between the rows. You have them 8 feet up so you can still plant crops underneath them. The benefits of that is that it actually provides some shading to the crops in the summer, and that way you can get a longer growing season. And in many cases, the crops you're growing, instead of traditional alfalfa or hay, you can grow tomatoes, squash, kale, beans, and these are more profitable crops, and it's local production of food. So this can be a win-win thing. The bees and pollinators, putting native grasses in there, having sheep run there, the previous talker, you know, discussed that. That's a wonderful thing. I think there's 20 different states have solar panels where they have sheep grazing in that area, you know, providing dual use for the land. So I think one of the big issues is that when solar comes to a particular neighborhood, whether it's a rooftop solar, a developer, or a massive scale project like the one that was discussed, the local community standards folks, the city, municipal, the county boards, they don't know how to deal with it because they've never heard of agrivoltaics. But it's starting to change. You know, I think there's a dozen states now that have developed, in some communities, standards for solar siting, talking about diversity, talking about ground cover, you know, encouraging pollinator-friendly sites. The Department of Energy has done a wonderful study to the Argonne Lab that said these pollinator-friendly solar sites have a lot of environmental benefits, 2/3 more carbon storage potential, less runoff, less soil erosion. So what are the negatives? Well, it's slightly higher cost to put the panel up a little higher, space them out more. You need a little more land. It's more expensive to plant native grasses and crops, and instead of just letting the weeds take over, which some of the earlier solar arrays did. But the benefits are there, so I'll shut up and let someone else talk.
No, thank you so much. It's very insightful. I think something that I was wondering was, Daryl and Pete, you both come from engineering backgrounds, so it may seem like an easy solution to harness the power of the sun and use it for energy, but others may not see it that way. So, Daryl, what would you say to someone who, you know, doesn't have the same background as you in maybe understanding all of this and how it works, to let them know that it's a good solution?
It's really, really simple. Pete comes from a background in physics, and he and I both are speakers with Siren and Solarize Indiana. We're educators to explain to people, and seriously, the real problem with solar generally in this part of the country is simple. Most people don't understand it. They don't know about it. They haven't seen it. They don't know how to learn about it. So really, all in right now is providing a public service for that purpose. And the way it works, the sun sends photons. You can't really see them visually, but they're there. And a solar cell, which is the working part, center of the panel, it's like a sandwich with layers. Think about peanut butter and jelly sandwich, except it's really, really thin. The whole thing's about as thick as a credit card. And what happens, a photon strikes the surface, and it has particular materials there that allow electrons to be released. So the electron goes from the top layer to the second layer, and that physical movement of electrons is electricity. That's essentially it. And then it goes from the cell through the wire, just like water through a pipe. It takes the path of least resistance. The wire is connected to the electrical panel on the property. It goes in and feeds the circuits, operates lights, TVs, whatever you have. And if you're producing more than can be used on site, the electrons just keep on going. They go out through the meter, out to the transformer behind the house, and the neighbor uses that electricity and pays the utility company for it. That's the whole picture.
It sounds fairly simple, but I'm not a very scientific person or expert, so I will defer to you both on that. Pete, how do you use solar on your farm? You mentioned you use it for the water pumps, if I'm correct.
Yes, we have western Nebraska is a very rural area. It's 4,500 feet, so there is some dry land crop and some irrigation, but a lot of it is cattle ranges, and so cattle need water. You can use a traditional windmill. You know, you can spend money to bend in the windmill, but they wear out. They have gears and mechanical parts that fail. So the solution that we're using is to put a submersible pump in. Instead of paying the utility $5,000 to run out power to that pump, put a couple of solar panels. Three solar panels is all it takes. And you have a large tank, so it runs during the day and pumps more than enough what you need during the day. And then the excess water is used at night. And so that's the key. And if you have a cloudy day, well, you size the tanks for 3 days, you know. So that's the primary way. But we're also using it for other ways to provide power to barns and things like that.
Have you seen cost savings on your end?
Yes. Yeah. It certainly is if you want to lease new land, if you want to lease farmland. It's certainly cheaper than running utility. In one case, we had a range fire in land that we were renting and using their well. Well, this range fire burned the whole place down, and it's because of climate change. You know, there's more severe storms, and so we lost our source of water. So in that case, we had a couple options. We can pay $5,000 to have the utility run telephone poles and power lines out there, or we can put in a submersible pump. And there's no monthly fees. You don't pay every month if you're not running it. We run cattle in there maybe 6 or 7 months a year, and then it's sitting idle. So there was definitely a cost savings there. If you size it on your house to produce more power, then with net metering under the current law, you get reimbursed for that. But it's a legislature issue, and the legislature seems to be favoring the investor-owned utilities. They want to change the law to where if you produce excess power during the day, more than you need, and then use it at night, they only want to give you a 25% of the value of that power instead of full value. So that can greatly diminish the value of that. And that's happening in Pulaski County down there. CenterPoint is the vendor that handles that. And Duke Energy wants to do that in central Indiana. So that's why we need this education of solar at our legislature. But programs like what you're doing now does a wonderful service to the community. It helps educate people about solar that it isn't as simple black and white. It's a nuance. There's a win-win solution in here. You know, there's a study that in Boston area, in Vermont, two different places, they had apple orchards. When they put solar panels next to the apple orchard and they had a pollinator friendly, they had bees, hives in there, they got the largest crop that they ever had in 40 years of apples because of the increased pollination thing. So that's a wonderful thing, taking care of the environment. So I got some visitors here. I got to let you go.
Well, Daryl, what do you think of the state's push for clean energy? Is it too late? Is there still time to make a difference? As Pete mentioned, it seems like there's still some stuff that the legislature needs to decide on when it comes to excess storage of solar energy.
I think I should defer to Jesse, the next speaker, to talk about the political aspects, but just briefly, I can say with some confidence that in most topics, our state does not have a tradition of being recognized for leadership. We typically follow the example of other states. So right now, we are way behind in this race. And we have several other examples in nearby Midwestern states that we can copycat from. But one thing that we have learned is the industry is changing. It's getting better. It's maturing. The products are better. The prices are way much lower. We put our first project on our house 10 years ago, and we paid twice at that time what it costs now to do the same thing today. But the other thing that's changing is the utility companies recognize finally, some of them anyway, that wind and solar are the lowest cost source of energy on the planet. So they're starting to put in big projects. But their model is really the same thing they used almost 100 years ago, which is put in a big project and run the wires everywhere else from there. Similar to taking energy from a coal plant down by Owensboro, Kentucky, on the Ohio River at Rockport, and you have these transmission lines going all the way up to Fort Wayne. So some of the farmers might not like the idea of looking out the window and see wind turbines or solar panels. They'd rather look at beans or alfalfa or corn. But I think most of those farmers don't really appreciate looking at these transmission lines either. So where we're at now, we're at a transition point with Solarize Indiana and Solar United Neighbors. We have programs in several cities that are pretty successful to help people get solar on their properties. And because of the politics, we're beginning to shift away from the really small on homes into a mid-size application for commercial. For example, the Evansville Airport, not too long ago, put in a sizable solar project similar to Indianapolis, but completely different, because in Evansville, they put it on the parking lot. So when you park your car there, you have shaded, protective parking. And just think how many acres do we have in paved parking lots everywhere that could have solar there instead of putting it in productive farmland.
So there's different options. There's multiple ways to do it.
Right.
What if somebody wanted to put solar on their house and live off the grid? Would they still have to be in touch with the utility company, or could you just do this solo completely?
Well, what you just said was kind of counterintuitive. It can't really be off the grid and still be connected to the utility company. That's by definition. And some people, particularly in southern Indiana and really the Amish communities in north and southern Indiana, they're philosophically opposed to the grid. So some of them, for example, they'll have the lighting in their pole barn is an automobile or a truck headlight, which runs off direct current. So, yes, you can be off the grid if you choose to. But most people, particularly in cities where they have reliable grid power, they don't need to. There are very few power outages. It's very dependable. And when you do have an outage, usually they're pretty short duration.
Well, we have about a minute left. Pete, what would you say to someone who isn't sure if this is a good idea for their land and you want to convince them otherwise?
Well, I would encourage them to do their homework. You know, if you look at the social media people that are opposed to it, some of the information is based on incomplete data, you know. So we have to get beyond that. We have to get to where it isn't just a no solar, yes solar. We have to dig into the details, learn what other people are doing. This use of pollinator-friendly things, and, you know, if it's a farm application, you know, that can be a win-win. The farmers can end up getting better value for their crops. They can actually get better, more profitability for their farm. And at the end of the lease, they can give it to their grandkids. So that's a win-win for the farm. But I think you have to kind of get beyond the emotional issues. So thank you very much for this program.
Well, thank you to both of you. Daryl Vagas is a retired engineer with Solarize Indiana, and Pete Lundson is a retired engineer, farmer, and volunteer with Siren. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Is solar energy too good to be true? There are two sides to every issue, and so far it sounds like solar power seems to be a clean energy source that uses the sun to create power. But what about on days when there is no sun? And are there any elements of the process that could possibly still cause questionable things to happen to the environment? With us now is Jesse Carbonda, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Welcome back, Jesse.
Great to be back with you, Miriam.
Jesse, we've heard glowing reviews so far about solar energy, and I'm not one to try to find the negatives, but I have to say it all sounds great. Is there a catch?
Well, I do want to just reaffirm again the great environmental benefits of solar. You have no air emissions. You have no carbon emissions. You drastically use less water compared to fossil fuel projects. So those are all great virtues of solar, whether we're talking about utility scale solar like the Doral Energy Project or the projects that Pete and Daryl were talking about that were rooftop in nature. So in terms of the other side of the equation, it really is contingent on a few different things. One is, where is a solar farm sited and how is it designed? Those things definitely affect one's overall environmental assessment of it, right? Is it in a migratory bird corridor, or is it carefully and studiously away from that? Is it designed to be pollinator friendly, or is it going to have just conventional turf grass? Both of those have profoundly different implications for stormwater runoff, wildlife habitat, and so forth.
And that's the new term you're reminding me of that I learned, which I think it's agrivoltaics, being able to plant things around these solar panels and turning it into more than just a solar farm. Is that something you think is important for everyone to consider when they're working on these types of projects?
Absolutely. I mean, we're especially bullish, Miriam, regarding pollinator-friendly solar. So there's agrivoltaics, which means basically farming in and around the solar panels. And then there is pollinator-friendly solar, which is really about emphasizing the restoration of habitat. And in a state like Indiana, this is an especially important consideration. You know, we were once a land that was 90% covered by forests. Now it's only 20%. We were once 25% wetlands, a portion of which were forests, and now we're only 3% wetlands. So there's this great imperative to restore natural ecosystems. And we've seen these profound declines in birds. Grassland birds have declined by 53% in America since 1970. And we've seen a steady decline in managed honeybee colonies across America from the 40s until today. So that to me is a strong case for pollinator-friendly solar, which means putting native grasses and native wildflowers in and around these solar panels. But the other option, which you mentioned, Miriam, of agrivoltaics is also compelling as a way to help sustain farm operations when they're leasing most of their land for solar production.
We spoke a little bit earlier with the guests, touched briefly upon the legislature or just how solar is viewed within state government. Are you seeing any changes in the way the state views solar? Are they making more strides towards embracing it?
Well, the good news is that there's more interest, and that's reflected by the fact that in the 2021 legislative session, there were five rooftop solar bills that were filed, three of which were filed by both Republicans and Democrats. That's positive. But I think, as Daryl had mentioned, the policy climate is very, very difficult in our state. The electric utilities have enormous political clout in influencing the legislative process. What it's leading to is that these bipartisan bills are being denied the ability for hearing. And this has real practical and profound implications for Indiana's economy and environment. And that's not an overstatement in the sense that there are a lot of jobs that we could generate in solar energy if we have the right public policies in place. You know, there are, even today, even though there are a lot of great attributes, as Nick Cohen mentioned, about the economics and geography of Indiana, the policy climate isn't mirroring that. And what it's leading to is foregone opportunities to grow the number of installers, the number of employees per installer in our state, the number of component manufacturers in our state, and that means foregone jobs. So we really need to adopt things like extending net metering, adopting third-party community solar legislation, third-party financing, and then we'll be on our way.
What are your thoughts on solar farms in general? Like when we're talking about this, the largest one coming to Indiana, is that good for our environment from that perspective, bringing clean energy? But then what about, I don't know, maybe it's just that people, when they see a lot of panels, it just seems like a lot of panels. Like, what else is going on there?
Exactly. No, I mean, I completely appreciate that. And just to kind of zoom out here for a second, you know, we're tracking about 33 of these utility scale solar projects across Indiana. And the average acreage of these projects is 2,400 acres. And our calculation is that by the end of this decade, we could have as much solar built over the next 9 to 10 years as the entire state park system in Indiana. So it's a large land footprint, and that's why we're so passionate about environmentally friendly design of these solar farms. Are they designed in such a way that they look aesthetic? And so they don't look like just a sea of solar panels, even though that they are interesting to look at, but that they also are resplendent with native grasses and wildflowers. And that builds a lot of community enthusiasm for these projects. You see it in the sense of school kids coming to visit these solar farms, essentially having a STEM curriculum component to their education by visiting these farms and learning about the physics of solar panels and the biology of the plants that surround them and the wildlife that visits and so forth. So it's just critical that these farms are designed right to optimize the environmental benefit.
Have you seen any changes in the way the state has been taking on these projects? Like it seems there's been an agreement for this mammoth project. The governor was there breaking ground. Is that a change from past positions?
Well, I think that finally renewable energy is being embraced in a bipartisan way. We are seeing that by the fact that, Republican county commissioners are embracing these solar utility scale solar projects. We're seeing it, as you said, in Governor Holcomb going to a groundbreaking for this site. But what we're not seeing, even though the rhetoric has changed, which is important because we want these technologies to be embraced across the political spectrum. What's also important is that we translate that new and positive attitude about these technologies into public policy that facilitates their growth. And, you know, Miriam, we're especially bullish, even though we like solar farms, we're especially bullish about rooftop solar because it will create a lot of resiliency to the grid. You know, if a portion of solar panels get knocked out in one neighborhood, in another neighborhood they won't. And that means that power continues in the event of an extreme storm in the backdrop of climate change. In terms of reliability, if more power is produced on site, it means there's less congestion on the electricity grid, which increases reliability. It also reduces costs because you're reducing the need to build multi-billion-dollar transmission projects. And as we've talked about, it also conserves land. You know, each megawatt of solar energy consumes 5 to 10 acres of land. So while we definitely like solar farms, provided that they're designed right and sited right, we're even more enthusiastic about rooftop solar.
If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Jesse Carbonda of the Hoosier Environmental Council about solar energy. And Jesse, you've mentioned that rooftop solar is something that you really focus on. What does it mean for the average person, rooftop solar? Is this something accessible?
Well, that's a great question. And really, what happens in the 2022 Indiana General Assembly is very consequential to that question, because what happened was Indiana became the first state or one of the first states in the entire country where the legislature repealed a policy called net metering. And net metering allows for a situation that when one is consuming, is producing more energy than they're consuming on site, then they get credited for that power to the extent that it gets credited on their bill. And there are two drastic changes that are happening in that public policy. One is the outright elimination of that retail credit. And the other thing is the movement of policy from what's called monthly netting to instantaneous netting. There's not time to really unpack those terms, but the practical reality is that that change in policy drastically weakens the payback period of these rooftop solar systems. It makes rooftop solar a lot less affordable to the average Joe. It makes it a lot less accessible. And so one of the things that we, as a part of a broad coalition, are trying to do is extend net metering. Because if nothing changes in public policy, net metering will be eliminated in the middle of next year, putting us in the minority of states that is in that situation. But so there are bipartisan proposals that we and other groups are working on to try to extend net metering possibly for another 5 years and then kind of look to a different paradigm for how we credit owners of rooftop solar with all the benefits that they provide to the grid. But we'd certainly like to see an extension of net metering policy in Indiana for 5 years or so.
And just to make sure I understand correctly, so folks who have solar panels on their home, if they generate extra energy that they're not using, they can get that back as like a credit on their electricity bill?
That's right. That's right. And what length of that credit is really subject to when they put in their system. And, those people who will install by, 2022 will only have five additional years for net metering. And those people who install their solar systems after June 30th, 2022 will have no net metering benefit whatsoever. The credit will go down from the retail level, which might be about 11 or 12 cents per kilowatt hour, to on the order of 2 to 3 cents per kilowatt hour. And that really wrecks the economics of these rooftop solar projects, especially for people who live in low-income and lower middle-income communities.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking, if it's my solar panel and it's my spot of the sun that's that's generating that, that's mine. I should be paid for it.
Exactly.
That's just what I'm thinking. So I guess it's just interesting to see how this is all going to come about. We know that our state is positioned well to distribute solar powered energy, as we've heard from some of the guests earlier. Could Indiana become an example for other states without this net metering drama that's happening, but in general?
Well, I think that we are poised to be a national leader in solar farms. By virtue of the fact that, we'll have possibly 8,500 megawatts installed by the end of the decade, which would position us as being the fourth most aggressive growth in solar farm energy in the United States. But in rooftop solar, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot by eliminating net metering and not allowing for hearings to extend net metering, number one, and to move forward and hear bills related to third-party financing, third-party community solar, and PACE financing, all of which would pave the way for making rooftop solar more affordable to the average Joe, more affordable to people who want to put it on their places of worship, on their small businesses, on their factories. One of the things that I really am pretty captivated by is the notion that we have all these Walmart and Amazon warehouses across Indiana, and we're seeing more of that because we're the crossroads of America. And yet they're barren, right? They all only have air handling units on them. And wow, what a lost potential of using all that acreage of space on our rooftops to put in solar and therefore save a lot of farmland and potential land that can be restored for forests and wetlands.
Jesse, are we seeing any more movement toward adapting clean energy at larger scales in Indiana?
Well, I think the economics are very much, and I really appreciate Daryl's points there about the federal tax credit phase out and also correcting me that it's a 10-year extension, not a 5-year extension for those people who install after 2022. That's a very important fact. Miriam, to your question, Regarding kind of the broader landscape of clean energy, yes, I mean, I think that what has been fascinating about the economics of this industry is just, again, how profoundly we've seen a reduction in utility-scale solar. We've seen a 70% decline in solar. And so what that's meant is that when utilities issue these requests for proposals where they're saying, look, industry, tell us how we can meet our needs in our service territory. And what they're finding is that the lowest bidders are renewable energy projects. So I think that's something to be pretty optimistic about. I think that the next frontier in terms of this transition from a coal and natural gas dominated economy to a renewables economy is utility scale storage. And we've seen pretty significant reductions there, not as aggressive as solar, but there's a tremendous amount of entrepreneurs working in that space. So I'm excited to see that possibility of Indiana being positioned there as a leader too.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up, I'll ask you what I've asked some of our other guests. What would you say to someone who's a little bit hesitant and maybe would contemplate potentially using a solar panel but isn't sure?
Well, join us tomorrow at Green the State House because we're going to have a dedicated panel on solar energy, Miriam, at hecweb.org/GTS. But more generally, to your very genuine question, I think that there is just a lot of good published information about it. You know, we have a portal, hecweb.org/solar, where we talk about, you know, all the different technical dimensions of solar projects, the environmental dimensions of them, the project development and financing considerations. So, you know, we try to cite our information to neutral sources. And we hope that, that the merits of it will become very clear through that study.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jesse Carbonda, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Thank you to all of our guests today. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.